This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Here's a question. Is the law consistent? It's a vitally important question when you're talking about justice in a nation of laws. It's the question that Jack Russell Weinstein posed for his monthly radio show, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs Sunday at 5 Central on this station. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg talked with Jack about the topic and its relevance to everyday life.
Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, as always.
What made you want to pick this theme?
Well, I've interviewed a bunch of lawyers over the last 12 or 13 years, and there's always a point where I, as a philosopher, say, hey, there's something missing, or there's a hole here, or this doesn't seem like the thing that you said 10 minutes ago. And the lawyers always answer, yeah, that's the law. You as a philosopher are looking for something different. You're looking for consistency. You're looking for comprehensiveness. You're looking for a whole world of justification. And what we do is follow the law and follow precedent. And so I was very interested in the question, is the law consistent? Does the law do everything it's supposed to do? And ultimately, underneath it all is the question, is the law satisfying? And that's really what motivated me to ask the question.
Well, I want to give you an example that when people hear the podcast will make a lot more sense, but we'll, you know, flesh it out in this conversation too. Of one time I was talking to my daughter and I said, Addie, will you please put a tablecloth on the table? And I think she was, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old. She took the tablecloth and she just threw it on the table. Technically, she did exactly what I asked, which was to take the tablecloth and put it on the table. But of course, what I meant was take the tablecloth, spread it out so that there is a piece of fabric that goes to all four corners and the whole length, width, breadth, depth of the table, and ideally sort of smooth and, you know, even out on all corners. But I'm not going to say that. But why I bring that up is because, to me, one of the most compelling parts of the episode, which comes up this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, is the example of someone who was charged with a crime, who asked for a lawyer, dog. That's the worst me trying to sound cool when I talk. But, you know, he's using slang, essentially, they say he asked for a lawyer dog, not a lawyer dog. You know what I mean?
I do. And let me give a background because it's not like a Disney film. He wasn't asking for a dog lawyer, right? He
was right. D-A-W-G dog.
Right. He was stopped for a crime. He was asked a bunch of questions and he said something like, and lawyer dog is the exact phrase, right? He says, no, dude, I guess I need a lawyer dog, you know, and
right.
We know what he means, but over and over again, the police said he didn't really ask for a lawyer. And then they appealed to a court and the court said, nope, he didn't ask for a lawyer. And then there was another appeal. And we know what he meant, but the courts and the police and the lawyers were using technicalities to avoid their own culpability in not giving him a lawyer when he needed it. And so there are two different issues here. The first is the larger structural issue, which is, as far as I understand, as it was explained to me, the person who said this was black. And as we know, there are structural racist issues in our courts. And so one can imagine that a white person would not have had the same thing happen to him. But, you know, one never knows, right? But the second thing is that law takes things very, very seriously. And specific terms have to mean very specific things. So, for example, here's an example that I use with my students that comes out of one of the essays we read. There's a sign in a park that says no vehicles. and a little kid has a little electric car and he's driving through the park, and does he get a ticket? Now, the intent of the law is no motor vehicles, no, you know, cars and trucks and snowmobiles and things like that. But the law also has to be written vaguely so that if there are new kinds of vehicles that come up, the law still applies. So, for example, if the law was written 30 years ago and it said no four-wheeled motorized vehicles, and then someone comes along with or gas-powered vehicles, and someone comes along with a three-wheeled electric motorcycle, well, then that would be legal. So the law has to be intentionally vague to include a lot of different options, but that vagueness can be used as a weapon as well. And so the best lawyers are the lawyers who can manipulate that vagueness for their own goals.
Well, it to me is a case of where obviously the intention, the morality, or the ethics in this case supersede the legality here. Like, obviously, morally, those cops knew. Ethically, they should have given that guy a lawyer, even if the law could be interpreted as they didn't have to.
This is the central question, really, of the discussion, and this is the central question of philosophy of law. What's the relationship between legality and morality? So, for example, most of us think that adultery is immoral, but most of us also think that it shouldn't be illegal. Most of us think that lying is immoral, or in certain cases is immoral, but in most cases, it's not illegal. There are certain circumstances when it is, right? When you're under oath in court and you promise to tell the truth, then lying is perjuring yourself. There are all sorts of other things that historically some people have tried to make legal when they thought they were moral, like worshiping a certain god, or, using drugs, for example, right? Sometimes those immoral acts should be made illegal, and sometimes those immoral acts shouldn't be made illegal. And it's a matter of contention. And what ends up happening is whoever is in power, whatever that means in any given context, gets to impose their own morality on the situation. But we live in a diverse and pluralistic society where we believe that people are allowed to choose their own God. They're allowed to choose their own sexual behavior. They're allowed to choose, this is expanding, what kind of drugs they want to use or not, right? Now we're starting to see that people can choose marijuana as opposed to just alcohol, which is a kind of drug. And we have to make the law as separate from morality as possible in order to have as wide a range of citizens as possible. So, yes, you and I think that this person, that it was immoral for the police to deny this person access to a lawyer. And maybe they thought, and I'm not justifying this, but maybe they thought, hey, we really know that this guy committed the crime and we just need him to confess. And so we're not going to give him a lawyer because we're going to get him to confess, which in fact he did. So what's more important morally? Abiding by the law and giving someone their rights, or stopping a criminal and holding them accountable, that is a matter of discussion.
How did you find P. Andrew Torres, your guest for this conversation?
He has a podcast called Opening Arguments, which I had heard a lot about. My wife listened to, another really good friend of mine who's at the law school listens to it. And one day I just started listening to it and I fell in love with it. And I really fell in love with his intellect. He's got a great voice. He's got a, you know, not just a radio voice, but a calming voice. I mean, he talks about the most controversial things and all sorts of political stuff that stresses me out. But he does it with good-natured, calm, you know, audio quality, the thing that all of us on the radio try to do.
And yes, he's very audiogenic.
And he's also really, really smart. And that actually comes out in my conversation with him. I actually think that opening arguments in a certain sense doesn't do the wideness of his intellect justice, because he's engaged in a very narrow task of explaining and interpreting the law for general audiences. And in the Why episode, he was able to really talk about philosophy and history and really expand the conversation. And he did it 100% accessibly, slowly, calmly, with great humor. And so I just wanted him on the show, and I'm so glad he was on the show. And in fact, my wife is much more excited about him being on the show than me being on my own show, right? She's I'm tired of him, but she has been
novelty anymore.
No, I'm not. I'm not. But she has been looking forward to this show for a really long time. And so that's where he came from. He's just a lawyer who got involved in the podcasting world and has had really good success.
Yeah, just in the conversation that I overheard between the two of you, you know, it's, you feel like you can understand philosophy of law and just breaking down the law in a really nice, digestible way. And again, the episode airs this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. And one of the parts of the conversation, a main theme in the conversation was this discussion on language, the focus on language, and how that purposely convoluted language, circuitous reasoning, when it's only meant to just make things less accessible to normal people. He's trying to get rid of some of that, which sounds like a very difficult task. And you don't get into this in the episode at all, but I'm wondering, as you are paying attention to how this is being taught in schools, are you seeing a change at all? An understanding that there's room for legalese and lawyers can talk in legal jargon, but lawyers to other people, really, they need to be more responsible, reasonable in their word choices.
So there's a couple things going on at the same time. The first is our culture is renegotiating what it means to rely on experts, right? Over the last 4 years, we've had a major discussion about the role of truth and whether or not it's okay for a president to lie and whether or not certain things that happen right before your eyes are just a matter of opinion or not. And over time, our nation has decided, or I should say is negotiating, how important it is to listen to experts. So we want an expert to fix our car. We want an expert to do our heart surgery, but many people don't seem to want an expert to tell us how to respond to COVID-19. And many people don't seem to want an expert to tell them to wear a mask. And many people don't want an expert to tell them whether to open or close or visit a business. So one of the things about lawyers is that they're experts, they're specialists, they're trained in a certain way. And because the law is so complicated, everyone needs this to get what they want. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is law school pedagogy is how they teach in law school is notoriously bad. And so it's very much the old standard lecture model where students take notes and listen and then answer very direct questions from the teacher. And there's very little discussion. What that does is it makes it much harder for lawyers to talk to ordinary people when they get out of law school because they don't use the same kind of critical evaluation. And I can say that's not exclusive to lawyers. I often say, you know, with anyone who gets a PhD, right, and this was certainly true in my case, the first 5 years after you write your dissertation, you can't talk to anybody about what you did. You're so completely immersed in your technical discussion that communicating it is really impossible. So the second part of it, right? The first part of it is the sense of expertise and what an expert means and their role in society. The second part of it is the ability of the lawyer to communicate or the specialist to communicate. And then the third part is how much do we want or expect an ordinary citizen to know what the law says, right? Here's an example that Andrew uses in the show. The speed limit on 29 is 70 miles an hour, right? No one goes 70 miles an hour. People go 73 miles an hour or 75 miles an hour. And if you got a ticket for going 71 miles an hour, you would be furious, right?
Right.
You would be just, you know.
But technically, broke
but
the
technically,
law.
that's the law. And we also know, as Andrew pointed out, that if you're going 75, 80 miles an hour and you get stopped by the police officer and you say, you know, this woman who I'm driving is about to have a baby and I have to get her to the hospital, the police officer most likely is going to say, okay, follow me, right? So technically, the law has a specific speed limit, but there's variability in that. We understand that the speed limit really means a range of things. But what the speed limit also does is give the police officer an excuse to stop somebody if they're driving erratically or if there's something suspicious about the car or if they're, you know, looking for a certain car or something like that, right? So the purpose of the law isn't simply to get people to obey a strict rule. It's also to create a collection of proper behaviors that then are useful to the society for a variety of different reasons, including the person who is bound by the law. And so this disconnect between the lawyer and the ordinary person is also about how you strategize to use the law to your benefit, or your prosecutor or the person who's trying to sue you or whatever uses to their benefit. And it's a game. Right. This past Sunday was the Super Bowl. Right. And lots of people who watch Super Bowl know a lot about football, but presumably the coach knows a lot more than the people who are watching. And there's defensive coach and offensive coach and all these other things that I don't know very much about. And they have to have a strategy for winning the game, just like lawyers have to have a strategy for winning for their client.
I wonder about that emphasis on winning. And I mean, it's true. If I am guilty and I hire a lawyer to do her job of defending me, then it's her job to use everything in her legal willpower, even though I would be technically guilty. Going back to that, how we teach legal ethics and how we teach legal morality, should we be thinking more about that end of it? That when the final product is just the lawyer wanting to win at all costs?
That's a great question. And it's an important question because it gets to the core of what we think justice is in our society. So, for example, in the classic Greek world, justice meant the universe being in proper order. So the person who should be king, Odysseus from the Odyssey is an example of this, is the person who is king. And then the person below them is the person who should be below them. But that's not our conception of justice. Our conception of justice is an adversarial conception of justice. Our conception of justice says that each person in the courtroom gets represented to the best of the lawyer's abilities and to the best available resources. And so the prosecutor has to do everything the prosecutor can to find the person guilty. And the defense lawyer has to do everything the defense lawyer can to find the person guilty. And if that happens, if the procedure is followed properly, then whatever the outcome is, we consider it just. Now, notice that justice has nothing to do with truth there. Justice has nothing to do with justice there. Right. Justice has something only to do with procedure and following the rules. And the idea behind it is if everyone has the same procedure and if everyone has the same rules and if everyone gets the same representation, then whatever the result is, we'll call it just. But that leads to the great question of inequality in our country, right? If one group of people or one area of the country gets worse representation, then the system falls apart. If all defense lawyers who work for the government who are given free to the poor are overworked and only get to spend a half hour preparing for a particular case, which is usually the case, and the prosecutor gets to spend 6 months preparing for a case, then that's an imbalance in the procedure. So that's one of the reasons why so many people are interested in law reform and why there's such stringent, such aggressive calls for giving more money for public defenders and things like that. Because since we have an adversarial theory of justice, since we are based on the idea that an outcome is just, not whether it's true or false, but rather whether or not people got the same treatment, the moment you get different treatment, you can't call it justice anymore.
I wonder if there could be more like a medical school approach where even if you're going into a special of, you know, podiatry or something, like you have to do a rotation in pediatrics or something.
Well, this is actually really interesting because there was for many, many, many years a law clinic at the University of North Dakota Law School. Many, many, many schools have law clinics and certainly not all students, but a bunch of students got to practice law, real cases for people who needed them and for people who needed representation who couldn't afford it. And when the legislature cut the budget and UND had to go through a round of budgets, they closed the law clinic. And that's a precise example of when you are cutting education costs, what budgets, when you're giving the university less money, eventually, right? I mean, sometimes it's the faculty that suffer, but eventually it's the students that suffer. And in this case, it's the people of Grand Forks County that suffer because the law clinic was an option, an opportunity, a resource. That's where the law clinic was a resource for people in the region to get representation that they wouldn't otherwise been able to get or afford. And that got taken away.
Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's always fun. And it's so incredibly cold out. I'd much rather talk on the radio than do anything else.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg with Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs Sunday at 5 Central. Coming up on Main Street, our Friday news chat with news director Dave Thompson and a new movie review from Matt Olean. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A House committee is looking at a bill to change the residency requirements to vote in North Dakota. Hazleton Republican Representative Jeff Magrum's bill would raise the residency requirement from 30 days to 1 year for someone who moves to North Dakota from out of state and from 30 days to 90 days for someone in North Dakota who moves to another county. Magrum told the House Government and Veterans Affairs Committee.
And the reason that I brought this forward is some folks are concerned that if you have a very close legislative race or other local race, that people would maybe pack into a county for 30 days just to influence the legislative race. So that's all there is to it.
But Deputy Secretary of State Jim Silroom testified the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on the issue in a 1972 case.
Justice Marshall said 30 days is enough time for a state or a county to do whatever administrative work is necessary to to make sure that the ballot box is pure.
Also testifying against it were Native American groups and higher education student groups. Kaylin Reedy is the vice president of UND's student body.
I fear that if House Bill 1289 is to pass, students will lose the opportunity not only to influence the communities in which they might live for 4 years of their lives, they may also lose the opportunity to learn what it means to be a good citizen.
The committee has delayed action on the bill until next week. Magrum says he plans to offer some amendments. Utilities across Minnesota say unpaid bills are piling up during the COVID-19 pandemic. Officials in Moorhead are taking steps to address the issue. Moorhead Public Service General Manager Travis Schmidt says some people haven't paid a utility bill in 12 months. He's not sure if it's in the best interest of customers to let that debt keep growing.
If we let the bills continue to stack up and stack up, how does that impact them long term? Is it worse than going back to normal?
Schmidt says there are a number of financial assistance programs to help customers catch up.
Utilize those funds, get the relief, get their balances down first, and then once that's done, and we'll work on the payment plan portion.
Schmidt says customers on a payment plan are allowed up to 2 years to catch up on utility bills. And the North Dakota House has decided it's time. Time to put the state on year-round daylight savings time, that is. Rolla Democratic Representative Marvin Nelson.
One, it's good for business. More evening hours, people go to the store, people go to the golf course, people do different things. Also, the time change is unhealthy. There's always, when the clocks change, an increase in car wrecks and suicides and in general health problems.
Some thought the bill's time had not yet come because Congress has to allow it. And Hamden Republican Representative Chuck Damshin says he would have preferred that the bill keep the state on standard time.
It's been said that only government would cut 1 foot off the end of a blanket and sew it on the other end and think they had a longer blanket.
The measure passed 57 to 35 and will now be considered in the Senate. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Ah, the sounds of the wire machine in the background. It's time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about a week when the legislature was meeting and talking about lots of stuff.
Boy, there was a lot of stuff on the agenda, yes.
But before we get to that, an update on COVID-19 vaccines. We're getting a little bit more, I take it.
We are. And very soon, well, first off, you have Thrifty White, who's going to start offering vaccines, which is good. Apparently, those are going to be the Moderna vaccines. But that's upped our vaccine dose counts here in North Dakota. And what's happening in the Biden administration looks like that number may go up further. It's something to watch, probably something next week.
Well, when I looked at the numbers in your story or in Danielle Webster's story, the total is around 15,000 doses a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that would seem to make it a pretty long haul to get everybody vaccinated.
Right. So they're really hoping to kick that up a little bit more if they can. Actually, you know, when Moderna gets more of the vaccines in and some of the other manufacturers like Johnson & Johnson come on board, we'll see those numbers go up.
Okay. But we should also remember that for most of these vaccines, it's two shots, too.
Right. The Johnson & Johnson one's the outlier. It's a one-shot thing.
Okay. Meanwhile, I'm in group one, but not in the right part of group one yet. So I'm waiting patiently, as you are, too, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yes, that's right.
Let's talk about your headline here, Dave. Earlier today, you put a headline out that said, House snuffs out tobacco tax increases.
Yes. There were two bills in the House. One would have added a dollar to the tobacco tax per package of cigarettes, per 20-pack. And also the second one would have done that and also expanded it to things like snuff, pipe, and cigars.
Okay.
And they both went down in flames.
Okay, so that means that North Dakota remains this kind of island of low tobacco taxes.
We are 49th in the country in terms of our tobacco tax.
And who's 50th?
Alaska.
Okay, it's a fur piece away.
Yes.
That's probably why so many Minnesotans drive across the Red River every day.
Yes.
Okay, but I was intrigued by Rick Becker, the very conservative Bastiat leader in the legislature, saying that he doesn't like the idea of sin taxes.
Right, right. And yet, there are sin taxes all over North Dakota's century code. And I happened to be covering the legislature in the late 1980s when there was a discussion about adding a special tax to soft drinks.
Yes, I remember
and,
that.
Yeah, if you remember that, the legislature voted to add another tax to soft drinks. So there are sin taxes out there.
Okay. To be continued.
To be continued is right.
Because that tobacco tax comes up every legislative session, it seems.
It does.
The House has passed a bill to require high school athletes to compete on the basis of their birth gender.
Right, and this is aimed at transgender students. You know, boys who are going to become girls, girls who are going to become boys, they're probably undergoing some hormonal treatments. And the legislature has an argument there that I shake my head at a little bit, but, you know, I can't discount it just yet, that this was a way to protect Title IX of the Education Code, which says you must have, you know, equal for both men and women in sports and high schools.
Well, Title IX is a federal law, and I don't hear anybody in the federal government saying that, arguing right now in the new Biden administration that there shouldn't be an equal playing field, period.
That's correct. That's correct. And this is part of a nationwide effort to get states to adopt these transgender laws. Apparently, I think it was Mississippi just did, too. And I believe it's pending in a couple of legislatures this year.
Well, this strikes me as the politics for a very specific group of voters, you know, not the kind of thing that's going to pass a court test.
Right. And remember, this is only one half of the equation because it passed the House. It's a House bill. Now it goes to the Senate. See what the Senate does with it.
So is the North Dakota Senate generally more reserved like the U.S. Senate for that
matter? Pretty much. And here's why that is, because if you look at it, and I think one of the speakers made this point on the House floor, that what you're doing is you're opening up the checkbook because there are going to be lawsuits on this if it does pass. The Senate's always been cautious about going down that road.
Well, let's talk about this batch of election bills that you reported on earlier this week. There is a lot of stuff.
An awful lot of stuff. And it goes from redistricting, which they're going to have to do because of the census numbers, to a bill that would require if you move to North Dakota, you have to wait a year before you can vote. That was roundly attacked in a House committee today. And the sponsor of the bill is going to try to pull in some amendments to try and save it. But listening to the Deputy Secretary of State, Jim Silroom, who said, look, this was found unconstitutional in the 1970s. The Supreme Court says 30 days is enough to make sure you have a clean and pure election.
Well, that brings up the whole issue of why are bills proposed that are likely to face constitutional tests?
That is always an interesting question. There are a couple of things at play there. Number one, there's really no vetting of bills. The Legislative Council is instructed to draft bills. They can't say, we won't draft it because it's blatantly unconstitutional. A legislator can introduce a bill that is possibly unconstitutional. Also, there's feeling that North Dakota could be a test case in the Supreme Court hearing. And that was the case with a few of the abortion bills a few sessions ago. They passed the abortion bills simply to get Roe versus Wade back before the Supreme Court. There is a cost that is attached to that, and that is the state loses, it might have to pay court costs, plus it has to pay for the attorney general's time and money to send attorneys out to the Supreme Court.
There's a skeptic in me that's trying not to be cynical, which is that sometimes bills are proposed not to be passed, but to go back to your constituents and say, look what I tried to do on your behalf.
And, you know, legislators will tell you, you know, one-on-one, there are such things as statement bills.
Yeah.
And there are some things like that.
But it makes you also wonder if there isn't this sort of vetting process for the constitutionality or the legality of bills, why the individual lawmakers themselves don't actually do that due diligence.
Well, they don't do the due diligence because they have a mindset. And you can understand, you know, these are citizen legislators. They're probably not – a lot of them are not law trained. So they come up with ideas. And the Legislative Council is not staffed very much. I mean, there's not a huge staff there. And if they have to go research constitutionality of some of these measures, it's going to take an awful lot of time. You know, they get through 1,000 bills in an 80-day session. Some of these things do fall by the wayside.
Okay. I know that redistricting was on the, you know, agenda. There was a House committee hearing yesterday, and Ellen Chafee, who's with North Dakota Voters First and has real issues with the proposal that's going through the legislature,
and
was
very
concerned about that.
You notice a lot of her issues are about openness, transparency.
Yes.
Because the bill as written, that the work product, the original, you know, county drafts that are being drawn, are closed to the public until a final plan is proposed and they hold public hearings.
Yeah.
And she said it should be open from the get-go and that people should have a chance to look at some of these district lines that are drawn and see if it makes any sense.
And I think that the proposal they're looking at, because they're basically trying to weight the redistricting group to, you know, align with the legislature, would be like 8 to 9 Republicans to Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a supermajority that will draw district lines that might help sustain the supermajority.
Yes, and that's a real concern. But North Dakota has had a checkered past up until the 90s with some of its district lines that were drawn. There were a couple of court cases, and they had to throw them out and redraw district lines. But then in, you know, because there was a UND professor named Floyd Hickok who came up with a way, you know, a computer program that helped legislators draw lines, and those did pass constitutional muster.
Okay. Well, it would seem a computer would be reasonably objective.
Yeah, that's
right. Of course,
right.
Depends on what you're putting into it. Another issue about voting that came up and I think is facing a pretty strong headwind has to do with allowing a candidate for local office to have a party designation. That's come up before, too.
That's right, and that bill is gone now. They have killed that bill, and it was sold as this is going to be an optional designation. But then you had a couple of legislators that stood up and said, yeah, we have our district conventions, and we vet candidates for school board or for the city commissioner or the park board, something like that. And the argument against that bill is that they're saying, look, it's too hard to find candidates right now. And if you're in a small town, people know your propensities. You don't have to declare a party. And why are we trying to scare people away? So I know Representative Lauser from Minot has been promoting that bill, and he wants it to be, you know, not a requirement, but an option that you can declare yourself anything.
Okay. Well, stay tuned.
Yes.
A faithful elector bill is moving through the legislature. What's that about?
Well, basically, you expect when a presidential election is held and the pick electors for the Electoral College, you would expect them to follow the vote that was in your state, what the popular vote was. Well, North Dakota does not have a faithful elector law. So in 2016... John Olson, former Republican state senator from Bismarck, was an elector, and he said he got all sorts of emails and phone calls and snail mail from people who wanted him to switch his vote from the Republican to the Democrat. And that came up, and there is a movement by the Council of State Governments to make sure that all states have these faithful elector laws.
Yes, we've had a recent education in the Electoral College process.
Okay.
You had a story on Monday. The Capitol rent plan and state employees working remotely is going to be studied.
Right. Now, there was a plan that was proposed by the Burgum administration that each agency would have to pay rent for its footprint. Now, the idea was that, A, some employees could be working remotely, but, B, they're already paying rent outside the Capitol Tower. You bring them into the Capitol Tower, and then you're not paying double rent. So that's part of the theory behind that. But the Appropriations Committee in the Senate's not willing to take that bite at the apple right now.
Okay, but I think they've had a fair amount of experience right now with people working from home.
Exactly. There's a lot of empty space in the Capitol right now. At one point, there were, I believe the number was right around 7,000 state employees were working from home.
Wow. Okay. You've got your North Dakota legislative review coming up later today.
Right. And our guest is Republican Senator Nicole Poolman of Bismarck. delightful. We talked about her priorities in the legislature, the bonding bill. She is chairing a subcommittee on the career and technical education budget. She's also on a committee that's looking at the corrections budget, which is a huge budget. And we had a chance to talk hockey.
Okay.
Because, number one, she described the legislature, and I think rightly so, as a three-period hockey game. We're coming to the end of the first period. I had to interject that, you know, I'm an alum of UND, and I'm a Fighting Hawk fan, and two of her children played hockey at UND.
Okay. So you know these people.
I know these people, okay. Yes.
Well, speaking of which, you were talking to me before we started to have this discussion about an intriguing legislative debate between a couple of pretty well-known legislators.
Right, and a couple of the oldest members of the legislature, the most senior members, and it was over the pay plan. The Senate has adopted a 2-2. Well, Senator Mathern has a 3-3 and tried to amend it onto an existing bill, moved the amendment, got a second, that opened up the discussion. And he was talking about things like Kumbaya and the canary in the coal mine. Well, Senator Holmberg, who chairs Appropriation, came back and said, a bill like this is kind of like that old story from India about all the blind men who are feeling an elephant. And they like part of it and they don't like part of it. And he said, you know, it depends. We have to wait until March 19th for the new revenue forecast. And the analogy was great. He said, it could be an elephant. It could be a donkey, but one thing's for sure, the canary is dead.
Okay.
And it was done so respectfully, it was just fun.
All right.
Listen to him.
It's always nice to hear about a debate that is civil and entertaining.
Absolutely.
We check in with our news director every Friday. Dave, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Break it down! Break it down!
Startling scenes from the Capitol riot presented at former President Trump's impeachment trial. They make a difference to Republicans who support him. Also, we'll talk to the writer and director of I'll Meet You There, a movie about being caught between two cultures and two worlds. Those stories, plus the news Saturday and weekend edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Lights, camera, action. It's time to go to the movies again with Matt Olien. Matt, you went to one titled The Little Things with a cast that is incredible.
Yeah, great cast. Saw this at the theater. It is in theaters right now, like a lot of films right now. That's kind of that you can see News of the World streaming. You can also go to the theater. Same with Promising Young Woman and same with The Little Things. Now, this is basically an old-fashioned police thriller.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to like it a lot better than I did. John Lee Hancock directs. He's got a pretty good resume, The Founder, The Blind Side, things like that. You know, it's professionally done. It's interesting when it's on screen. You mentioned the cast, three Oscar winners in this. Denzel Washington plays, see if you can recognize this cliche, kind of the ex-detective who liked to break a few rules, who teams up with the hotshot young detective played by Rami Malek from Bohemian Rhapsody. So that plot should sound familiar to you in a cop show. And there's a little too much familiarity for my liking. The film gets really lost into the details of police work. There's not a lot of action in it. I want to tell viewers that as well. It involves kind of the age-old plot. They're after a serial killer, and they're trying to figure out who it is. It's not bad, but the problem with the film is there's not enough action. I think it gets bogged down into too much police detail, and I did not like the last 15 minutes. I think the film tries to be kind of like Seven, you know, the movie with Morgan Freeman that was so good back in 1995, Brad Pitt, and it doesn't quite achieve that because there's not the sting in the tail. When I talk about sting in the tail, I think the last 10-15 minutes of the film are going to be a letdown for a lot of people. Uh-huh. And it was for me as well. It's a long slog, but where's the slog taking us? Is it leading us to something that's going to be satisfactory in terms of a climax, in terms of action? Let me say, when Washington and Malik are on screen, they have on-screen charisma that's amazing. Both of them do. And Malik, I think, does a pretty good job as the detective. Jared Leto shows up as a suspect. You'll have to go see whether he's a suspect or not, or just a creepy guy living in Los Angeles. He plays creepy people very well, as you know. But again, Denzel and Rami Malik have star wattage, star power. Denzel still is able to kind of get away playing that guy you don't want to cross. You know, he's still able at age 66 to kind of pull that off. There's just not enough teeth in the movie. It's solid. It's interesting when you're watching it. But at the end, you're kind of like, this feels like a longer TV segment of Law and Order. That's okay. Kind of how it felt to me.
I am always intrigued by the title, The Little Things. Mm-hmm. What does that mean in this movie? Is this police investigative minutia, or what is it?
That's part of it, Doug. Yes, Washington has a speech he gives to Rami Malek about the little things that eat you up, that get you caught. So in police work, it's often the little things and how they find the little things that can tie a suspect to a crime. It's also the little things in life, and Washington's character clearly has a lot of baggage. Again, I called him an ex-detective who liked to break a few rules. And so little things have eaten him up in his career over certain cases that he's covered that maybe didn't turn out well, or some that did turn out okay. And those little things kind of eat up a police detective, and you have to leave those at the office when you go home. And it's a very difficult thing to do for the two cops in this film. So I like the title of the film, and it gives Denzel a nice speech about life and police work at some point in the movie. But again, not quite what I was looking for in terms of one of those over-the-top solid police thrillers. Jared Leto is getting some awards love, though. He did get a supporting actor nomination for the Golden Globes. I don't know that will carry into the Oscars. And as you know, Doug, films released right now, this month and last month, are eligible for the 2020 Oscars. They had that weird rule bending where the first 2 months of 21, because of theater issues with COVID, could be eligible for the 2020 Oscars.
And I understand that movies that had a theater release planned but had to go to streaming will be considered for Oscars.
Yes, so they're exempt and will not be punished for not being in the theater.
All right. Well, you mentioned all of the Oscars that the cast of
yes.
The Little Things have won. It's four Oscar wins for three performers. So let's talk about two performers who left us last week that were legendary and lived long and fruitful lives.
Boy, Hal Holbrook and Christopher Plummer, two big ones on stage, on television, on film. You know, Plummer especially really had that great third act to his career. That's when the Oscar nomination started rolling in. He was able to really stay healthy right to the end, dashing and debonair to the end. Oscared for Beginners in 2011. Later in All the Money in the World, played J. Paul Getty, a nice late supporting performance. So he'll be so missed. Of course, still remembered for Sound of Music, a film he was not fond of. But I think over the years, he kind of softened to accepting that fans loved him for that performance. And Hal Holbrook, you know, his on-screen work, mostly supporting roles, Deep Throat and All the President's Men, Into the Wild, has a nice Oscar-nominated cameo. But again, best known as playing Mark Twain on television and stage through the years. So two giants of American drama left us last week.
Hal Holbrook started portraying Mark Twain when he was in college.
Yes.
And he had to put on old age makeup. He quit doing it 60-some years later when he didn't have to deal with makeup at all, maybe put on the white wig. Christopher Plummer, as you mentioned, like Holbrook on stage and on screen, but he won a Best Performance at Oscar late in life.
Yeah, Beginners, 2011. That was his supporting actor Oscar. At the time, he was the oldest winner, I believe, of the Academy Award, and later, with All the Money in the World, became the oldest actor ever nominated for an Academy Award. He was 88 when he was brought in to replace Kevin Spacey as J. Paul Getty.
Well, he was 91 when he passed away last week, and Hal Holbrook was 95. A couple of legendary performers. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
when you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 12th. One of the biggest rights Native Americans have fought for since white settlers came to this land is a right to education. While settlers provided boarding schools, the goals of these institutions were more about assimilating Native Americans than anything else. It wasn't until 1924 that Congress acknowledged the horrible educational and health care conditions with the Merriam Report, a survey of conditions on Indian reservations. In the 1960s, Native Americans began a self-determination movement, which led to the formation of tribal colleges. After hard work, the Navajo Nation established the first tribal college in 1968, and more began to follow. Wanting to strengthen their institutions, six tribal colleges founded the American Indian Higher Education Consortium in 1973. That same year, tribal leaders in the three affiliated tribes founded the Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College on the Fort Berthold Reservation. A steering committee developed the initial operations, but was soon replaced with the board of directors in 1974 when the school was officially chartered. At first, the school relied on other accredited institutions, which offered classes on an extension basis. The first schools they worked with were the University of Mary, Minot State College, and the University of North Dakota in Williston. After some long-range planning, the college improved the educational and vocational services, and on this date in 1988, the Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College was granted accreditation. The college continued to grow, and in 2011, it became a four-year institution when the accreditation expanded to include Bachelor of Science degrees in Elementary Education and Environmental Science, and Bachelor of Arts in Native American Studies. Tribal colleges are an invaluable resource for Native Americans. Native students are more likely to graduate from those schools. They have no college debt, and they contribute to their communities as they address some of North Dakota's most urgent workforce demands. A recent study estimates the colleges have an annual impact of $145 million on the state's economy. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online, and after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. On our show on Monday, the North Dakota Vocational Rehabilitation Division helps people with disabilities in the workplace. We'll talk about jobs for the disabled with Damian Schlinger, the director of that division, and Counselor Megan Stone. And Monday is President's Day. We'll share a discussion about the Constitution and information about an upcoming free online class to boost your knowledge. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.